Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hey, besties, this is the Ethics Experts. You got Gio Gallo here, excited to host you in a really interesting conversation with Chris Marquis today. Chris is the author of Better Business, and we're going to be talking today about how a new model for capitalism can make the world a better place, something that you all know by now is close to our heart. So, Chris, the subtitle of your book is How the B Corp Movement is Remaking Capitalism. So I'm really excited to get into that. You know, ethics experts, I think generally, and lots of the people in our audience understand that business can be a force for good in the world, and that ultimately, you know, all of the machinations we're doing to, you know, get revenue and manage expenses and make products and services ultimately only matters if it makes the world and, you know, specifically makes people better off. So I'm really looking forward to jumping into that, kind of how you came to the book and all of that. But I'd love to just, you know, we always like to tell personal stories here, Chris. So tell us a little bit about how you came to be the person you are today.
Sure. First, thanks so much for having me, Gio. Great to talk to you. So how I came to be the person that I am today. Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, what set you on this path, right? Not everyone is this passionate about this and has done these things. So, you know, what are some influences in your life?
Yeah, you know, one thing that's been a big influence in how I ended up doing this book is the students that I teach. So, you know, they're about a generation or two younger than me, you know, millennials, Gen Z, and they are passionate about purpose in their workplaces and what they buy in the companies that they found. And actually, you know, the first time I heard about the B Corp movement was in a class. I was teaching at the time at Harvard Business School, a class on corporate social responsibility, which for a long time had been my research interest. So companies philanthropy, work with nonprofits, large companies, you know, like IBM and Goldman Sachs, et cetera. And one student in the middle class one day said, you know, I don't know why we're studying all these large companies. We should be studying like small companies that have social mission embedded in them, like B Corps. I think this was around 2009, and I had never heard of B Corps. So I hope I mentioned in the class that I didn't know and had them explain a little bit. But I remember running back to my office afterward and Googling a bit, and then reaching out to the founders at B Lab, which is the nonprofit that does the B Corp certification, and then, you know, went and visited them and interviewed the founders and other folks, and then wrote the first Harvard Business School case study on B Lab, which was 2010. And then I did another one in 2015, as well as a variety of other B Corp, some of which, you know, I was introduced to via my students. So a big influence on me and sort of the hope I have in the world is that our younger generations are pointing in the right direction as far as, you know, wanting purpose and values in the businesses that they buy from and work for.
Right. That's great. That's it's really cool when the student can teach you, right? And that's what, you know, I think it's a sign of a great professor, Chris, when, you know, the students are contributing to the course and it's not just all on the slides, right?
Right.
That's cool. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, B Lab is a great organization. I think they just got awarded the most innovative company by maybe Fast Company. So that's nice to get some of that recognition. But let's talk a little bit about the book. Kind of, you know, you've been in this space in, you know, kind of CSR, corporate social responsibility and things like that. What kind of motivated this book specifically?
Yeah, I think, you know, and again, sort of as another story about my students. So fast forward to, I think it was around 2017, I was teaching at Cornell then, and one of the founders of B Lab, Jay Cohn Gilbert, came when I taught the B Corp ideas and case study in my class, came, and usually if a founder of a company would come or executive, I'd try to have a public event also, so not just my class, but the whole campus could be exposed to them and their ideas. So the first time I taught the B Corp case was in 2010, held a public event at Harvard, and I think, you know, maybe two or three people came. It was really sort of very low turnout. Actually, all three of the B Lab founders came, and like a couple students, which was a little embarrassing. But then, you know, in 2017, when I was teaching the class, and Jay Cohen Gilbert came and had this event, and it was a room of about 100 seats, and it was people sitting on the floor, crowding in the doorways to sort of hear about, you know, B Lab and B Corporations. And actually it was a sort of an epiphany moment at that time. You know, seldom do we have where something just, you know, crystallizes. I said, you know, I really should write a book on this, because I've done, you know, with the two B Lab case studies, I did case studies on six other B Corps. So it really was something that I'm like, you know, I should, this is something that's you know, trend in the world that's taking off, and it'd be great to really capture it as is, and hopefully help propel it forward.
Yeah, and you're definitely doing that. You know, you're doing a lot to give, you know, I think the heart and the mind something to grab onto around this B Corp model and social responsibility. And you know, it definitely makes sense to me. It seems like it's becoming a more and more a core part of the zeitgeist, and something that, you know, has gone from, you know, at least in the minds of leaders, something that's a kind of nice to have, let's see if it fits us, to it's increasingly kind of becoming essential to, I think, be competitive in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
So let's dig into the B Corp model. Kind of define for us what a B Corp is, and tell us kind of what's around that. Kind of before B Lab was certifying companies for this, you know, what are other ways that companies have treated, you know, their engagement with, you know, corporate social responsibility?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways that companies have engaged with society and communities over time. You know, obviously philanthropy is the sort of famous one. You know, it's sort of easy to do, to give money to nonprofits. You know, where I think the B Lab model though really stands apart from typical CSR is the sort of accountability and transparency aspects of it. So, you know, the B Corp, to become a B Corp, you are certified, the company be certified that their social and environmental performance is above a certain threshold, you know, by B Lab. B Lab is a certifying entity. So sort of like, you know, it's fair trade, organic, LEED, you know, those are certifications that assess kind of different products. So the B Corp certification is really the only one that certifies the whole organization. And to become a B Corp, you know, companies would need a score of an 80 out of actually about 200 points. On this survey, and go through some sort of verification and checking processes as well. And the areas are, you know, workers, community, customers, environment, and governance. So, and why I think this is important is that the tools and processes that have been developed to certify companies are now used by many, many more companies than B Corps. You know, many PE VC firms use these tools to assess their portfolio companies. You know, large companies like Danone are sort of merging it with its, you know, internal KPI and measurement system to provide a real robust, you know, management system for the whole company. So, you know, this is something where this sort of ideas of accountability and transparency have spread well beyond B Corps, and many, many other companies are using the tools.
Yeah, it's great. It's cool that, you know, we can kind of set these standards, right, and engage certain companies around these, but also someone who maybe doesn't get the certification can still learn from that and implement some of them, or start getting on their path that maybe 2 or 3 years from now they'll kind of be able to pass, but they can start building into it, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of the argument of the book, is that, you know, not that there should be more B Corps in the world necessarily, but more companies should be like B Corps. So they should, yeah, you know, implement these, becoming more sort of stakeholder governed, which, you know, this is something we haven't touched on it yet, but, you know, this is something obviously that's in the zeitgeist as well, the need for companies to become more stakeholder driven. I think this is a way that companies can actually look and see how to do that, because it's sort of, it's very systematic and provides some accountability.
Yeah, it's something close to our heart here at Compliance Line. Since my brother Nick and I kind of came into leadership roles here, we implemented, you know, a multi-pronged evaluation of our performance each year, and how do we impact our employees? How do we impact our customers? How do we impact, you know, our financial stakeholders and our owners, and then, you know, our community and the quality of the, you know, the services and the products that we put out. And, you know, it's something that people are waking up to. And it's cool. You know, I like the argument that you make, that there's this positive externality to kind of bringing this model in, you know, to use the LEEDs example, like not every building has to be LEED certified for that to start kind of trickling out, and, you know, right. other buildings having some of that, or just making the, you know, kind of the tools that make that possible more prevalent. And, you know, I think that there's right. a lot of good happening outside of just B Corp certified companies that's been driven by this model.
Totally.
You know, our audience is generally made up of ethics experts, you know, HR leaders, compliance leaders. So I want to start getting into at some point, you know, kind of how you can help educate our team on how to kind of help push forward this kind of conscious capitalism, this stakeholder approach, this, you know, social responsibility. But before we get into that tighter detail, talk to me a little bit about, you know, from your perspective, why has this kind of exploded in the past 5 to 10 years? It seems like it's gone from, you know, like we were saying, kind of something on the sidelines of, oh, that's nice that those people care about that, to everyone's trying to figure out how, you know, they can, you know, speak into this moment.
Yeah, interesting and important question. So, you know, one important phenomenon, and I don't know if it relates to just how dire the world is with, you know, issues of income inequality, environmental, you know, destruction, you know, in the U.S., you know, highlighting sort of the systemic racial injustices that have occurred. You know, I think that the, you know, business leaders are realizing, you know, these big problems in the world are things that not only that we can, but we should actually address. And so, you know, I think this is part of the, you know, underlying rationale for, you know, the Business Roundtable less than a year ago. This is the group of about 200 largest CEOs, the largest American companies, came out with a statement, you know, the company should be stakeholder driven, you know, look out for their employees, consumers, communities, not just their shareholders.
Right.
Other organizations like the World Economic Forum in early 2020 had similar statements. And I think two, so one is from, you know, this is something that's right to do. I think also many of these actors, you know, be they companies or investors, have come around to the idea that actually this can be profitable too. So, you know, Larry Fink, the founder, CEO of the investment giant BlackRock, you know, has been issuing letters for the last 3 years to CEOs saying, you know, you should be more purpose-driven. We're looking at purpose when we invest. And I must say, in sustainability and issues like, you know, carbon, because these are indicators of management quality, and they have long-term risk associated with them.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I think was not actually is covered by Larry Fink's most recent letter as should, is that he actually talked a lot about processes of accountability and ways that companies should, you know, track, report, and be accountable for their, you know, ESG, environmental social governance impacts.
Yeah, it's big. You know, I think you're from my perspective, the you know, maybe pressure is the wrong word, but the force that's pushing this forward is coming from a lot of different angles. You know, you've
right.
seen kind of pressure be put on endowments and foundations to not invest in certain areas of the economy or certain types of businesses
right.
based either on their values or their impact. I sit on a nonprofit board, and we help manage a foundation as part of that. And we're dedicated to investing in kind of the ESG space, you know, environmental, social, and governance focused companies. And, you know, like part of it is it's good business, to your point. There are pieces
right.
That come through, call it B Corp or ESG or social responsibility, that impact your long-term risk, that impact your ability to kind of weather a storm or to kind of be relevant as the economy continues to advance. And part of it is just, you know, I think people care about it and it's doing the right thing, which, you know, I tend to think kind of the money's going to work out if you do the right thing, even
right.
if you can't always put it into a spreadsheet and put it in, you know, cell C16 of your Excel model. You know, I think that doing things right is good business.
Yeah, no, I'd agree.
So talk to me a little bit about what you've seen kind of senior leadership at a company come around to as you've been around this over the past few years, whether it's specific examples or just kind of how it generally happens, how someone starts to change their mind from, hey, that's not us, you know, we make widgets and screws or paper or whatever, and then start to say, okay, you know, kind of what is the kind of persuasion or the path of someone changing their mind as they start to say, okay, we should probably get more serious about this?
Yeah, so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of reasons why companies end up becoming B Corps or actually start to engage with some of the sort of accountability tools. You know, one reason is that, you know, the employees want it. So, you know, one of the companies that I studied, you know, they actually had an employee contest or an employee vote, like what sort of initiative should we be doing? And so, you know, one of them was an employee said we should be a B Corp. And it turns out that actually didn't win. That was the second. I don't know what was first. But then, you know, the CEO said, you know what, this B Corp is really important. And obviously, even though it's only second, it's something that's important to our culture and employees, you know, we'll do it. More recently, many companies, and this also relates to actually putting the B Corp logo on their products. You know, which initially many companies didn't do because there were not as much brand value in it.
Right.
But, you know, a number of companies I've talked to have said, you know, now that this is well known, actually the brand itself, the B brand has value. And so, you know, we'll sort of start putting this on our products. I think a lot of companies, which maybe were initially a little bit resistant, because it takes time, it takes energy, it costs a little bit. But, you know, once they can sort of see the value, you know, from the B logo, they end up switching. So some they find, you know, that actually doing the work of going through the assessment, like sometimes B Corps will ask their suppliers to go through the assessment.
Yep.
And then the suppliers do that and they find out, well, you know, wow, this is actually very useful because, you know, the assessment is an assessment of social and environmental factors. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you know, looks at governance, you know, HR systems. And so, you know, many companies find it to be really like a useful playbook for, you know, ways to manage a company. So there's many reasons why companies sort of get started down the path, you know, through their different, be they consumer, be they employee, be they supplier ecosystem, and then, you know, end up, you know, finding value in it and making the choice.
Yeah, it really does seem like kind of a gravitational pull toward this. And, you know, there are maybe a bunch of different ways that you can get welcomed into it. But yeah, it's interesting to see that it can come from any one of those directions. You know, it's interesting how, you know, there's, you know, SOC 2 certification for some IT and process, you know, stuff. And there's, you know, NCQA for quality and you know, there are these types of certifications that oftentimes in an RFP, you know, a buyer is going to say, hey, we're going to give preference to this, or you have to do this. It seems like this B Corp certification really kind of hits a lot of things that we end up caring about as ethics experts of, okay, what impact are you making and how are people benefited or harmed from this? You know, I think I saw something, maybe it was on one of your blogs, about how up to 70% of millennials who are, you know, quickly kind of becoming the plurality of the market will make a buying decision, you know, for or against a product based on these types of features. You know, whether somebody is doing it well or not doing it well.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of research out there about, you know, millennials, both their purchase behaviors as well as their, you know, where they want to work. And I think it's really very encouraging to this trend. And I think the thing that, and Larry Fink even mentions this in his letter, that, you know, the amount of wealth from the investing angle, the amount of wealth that is going to be transferred from the baby boom generation to, you know, sort of the millennials, Gen Z, is like 30 to 40 trillion dollars. And so, you know, to this trend where you're talking about with your foundation and the rise of ESG investing, I think this is going to be another sort of factor that's going to explode to propel this forward.
Yeah, that's a big point. You know, I think people are talking more and more about millennials are becoming a bigger part of the workforce, and millennials are be driving more GDP. You know, kind of. You know, they have the pocketbook to make those decisions and things like that. I think that you know, that wealth transfer, whether it's direct kind of inheritance or just they're kind of now in the seat that's earning that, you know, that salary or whatever it is, it's really a strong force. And it's something that, you know, kind of say what you want about millennials, you know, that wave is coming. or it's here. And if that's the reality, I think we as leaders need to kind of get on board and figure out how to interact with it. I, for one, think that, you know, if companies are more honest, more transparent, more accountable, and, you know, have this balanced approach to taking care of their stakeholders, if that's being pushed by millennials, then I'm all for it. So maybe a little bit related to that, let's talk a little bit about the employee section of this, right? A lot of our audience are, you know, they're in HR and they're in compliance and focused on, a direct point of contact is employees. Talk to me about how kind of retention and attraction of talent is impacted by, you know, B Corp specifically or this broader movement.
Yeah, so I think, again, sort of here there's you know, broad research on companies saying values, socially responsible, both being places that attract better quality applicants, and then the people that end up being hired in end up staying longer. So there's a lot of evidence on this, you know, sort of attraction and retention point. From the research that I did, I do sort of weave in some studies into the book, but a lot of it is based on, you know, my interviews with B Corp leaders. And scores of B Corps told me that, you know, so many of the people that want that sort of apply for jobs, you know, there's a form section of the form that says, you know, how did you hear about us? Why do you want to work for us? A large number at many of the companies I've talked to say, because you're a B Corp. And so that's, and then, you know, there's also a lot of examples on retention as well. I mean, one example, one of the companies that I studied is a company called Rhino Foods. They make, probably most famously, they make the little sort of cookie chunks in Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Okay. And they make a variety of other sort of dessert type products. They implemented an employee short-term loan program. They partnered with a local financial institution. So if you have some car emergency and you need a real quick loan to sort of help tide you over, you can get it sort of offset against your payroll, and the bank helps facilitate it. And then, you start to build up a credit history and open a savings account and a system in place that, you know, helps the employee, but also in the short term, but also provides like a nice sort of long-term benefit for the employee too. So since they implemented that, their retention has increased by, I think, 39 to 40% actually. So it's, wow. You know, this is like one example. A number of other companies, you know, that I talked to, I mean, it's, you know, compared to their competitors, in high turnover businesses, you know, yeah. Sort of being, you know, where normally it would be like 80-90%, you know, they're, you know, more in the 20-30%. So
that's, I huge. Think,
it's a huge. So there's a big, you know, benefit, I think, you know, just from, you know, wanting to treat people in a humane way is obviously an important factor, but I think also
that's an end in and of itself, right?
Yes,
but there are these
exactly.
other things that end up working.
Right. Yeah. And it ends up, you know, if you think about it, sort of the cost of hiring and recruiting people, it's tremendous.
And I think it's really interesting, you know, the impact that this can have on high turnover industries like, you know, food services or, you know, right. It sounds like this is maybe a food manufacturing. I think, you know, a few years ago, a decade ago, people would say, hey, you know what, our people don't really care about that. You know, we have an industrial kind of blue collar base and, you know, they don't really care for, I don't know, recycling our paper towels. But really, right. You know, that's kind of a caricature of what this approach is. And this approach is really just understanding your stakeholders and taking care of the people who are impacted by your business, which, to your point, in an industrial setting like that, making a change that you said, oh, kind of people are turning over a lot. It's expensive, but that's how it is. You can really stand out from the crowd by doing something like that and making those employees kind of not just build loyalty to the company, but also kind of get their life on a better track, you know, where that, you know, that car emergency doesn't set them behind, you know, 2 years of savings or something.
Right. Yeah. Another example along these lines is a company called Boloco, which is a burrito chain in the Northeast, Boston, New Hampshire. They actually, you know, most of their employee base is Spanish speaking.
Okay.
And so they ended up actually, you know, contracting out some English language and career skill training that employees can do on the job. And they have some turnover, but their idea is that they actually want a little bit of turnover because they're hoping that their employees, you know, can actually become better, you know, can speak better English, can know how to write a resume, and then they can find, you know, a job somewhere else. You know, I mean, a burrito, you know, they're happy to, they give, you know, have very good wages and, you know, good benefits, but also realize that, you know, being a burrito maker is maybe not, you know, the job that everyone wants to have for their whole life. And so
yeah, they're maybe not going to retire doing that, but they can be kind of an on-ramp to another part of the career, right?
Exactly.
That's great. So, you know, you've talked about some anecdotes from the book and some of the interviews that you did. I wonder if anything stands out in the context of, you know, there's this dynamic that we have as leaders in, you know, integrity and ethics programs of, you know, kind of trying to get leadership on board with, let's kind of focus on this more. So, you know, we talk about how compliance and ethics has gone from kind of 1.0 in the 1900s of just, you know, legal defensibility, like let's not get sued. Right. To it's gone through this, you know, this curve of, okay, well, let's kind of be efficient about it and let's get some ROI and we should have something in place, to now, you know, a lot of people in our market are talking about, how do you actually make this effective? How do you actually make sure that the people that would be harmed by risk or, you know, that could be helped by a company, that we actually have that impact instead of just saying that we have something in place? I wonder if you have any anecdotes or, you know, just kind of guidance from being involved around this about, you know, how someone can advocate to a leader and say, hey, you know, let's look at this a little bit differently and let's kind of get on board with this. You know, even though this wasn't, you know, in your 5-year strategic plan, we should maybe reconsider elevating our focus on it.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. And, you know, one is, and I think implicit in what you're saying is that, you know, there is a long-term risk element to, you know, sort of slipping up in some ways. And so I think, you know, that's something that certainly, you know, if you think about, you know, one of the B Corps I talked to does sort of some food delivery in New York City, and, you know, they are very, you know, the delivery folks, particularly during COVID, they were very sort of proactive in helping them and getting them more pay. And, you know, you can see the sort of obvious, you know, pandemic situation, sort of underrepresented minority as the employee base. Yep. And if you treat them bad, I mean, this is like a disaster ready to have, you know, they do it, I think, because it's the right thing to do. But I think that there is sort of this long-term risk perspective is one. You know, you'd like to think that companies are doing it for the right reasons too, that it's sort of something that they just believe that they want to treat the sort of employees or customers, suppliers, whomever better. And I think that you do see that sort of in the B Corp movement. So, and I think that there is, I think the pandemic brought out a lot of the sort of downside risk. You know, you think about sort of supply chain issues, you know, a number of the fast fashion companies, you know, were sort of grilled over the coals for sort of really abandoning their suppliers. And these are, you know, folks in, you know, like Bangladesh or Vietnam, where, you know, again, sort of is not, the economic situation there is not great to begin with. And so
there's not a big safety net. Balance. They're not kind of a robust they're not a robust supplier with, you know, 2 years of cash on hand.
Yeah. And I think one of the examples that I found really inspiring in this is Danone, the global Danone organization. You know, when the pandemic hit, you know, they took a very systematic approach, like, okay, you know, what sort of programs can we put in place for our suppliers to make sure that, you know, they're getting the support they need? Because a lot of, you know, a big sort of input to Danone is milk. And I think there was a lot of issues with sort of transporting milk, being able to actually, you know, get it from the cows in the early days of the pandemic. And so much of it had to go to waste. And so how they were actually able to help their suppliers overcome that issue. They, you know, guaranteed employee contracts for an extended period of time. They, you know, had work in their communities as well, some philanthropy and then also they ended up maintaining the dividend. So, you know, we can't forget about the shareholders in all of this. I mean, they, you know, a lot of times stakeholder capitalism is really juxtapose against this sort of evil, bad shareholder capitalism. And I think that having a single focus is probably not a good thing. We can't forget that, you know, these are businesses that have investors and shareholders that obviously are a hugely important part of the overall mix of things. And so I think, I mean, those are some of the sort of examples that I have of companies that have thought about this as sort of a long-term risk and what some of the downsides are is when they are interested in implementing it. I think too, the investors are a very important lever. You know, for many companies, you know, obviously public companies have dispersed, you know, lots of institutions as investors, but many of the companies that we're talking about are privately owned, and, you know, they might be family owned, they might be, have VC investors. And I think the extent to which you can get the investors on board, it's easier to push these things through.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I think as we add these other stakeholders into the mix of consideration, it can maybe sound, you know, by the balance of the conversation that, you know, we're not focusing on shareholders anymore. And, you know, that's not what I've heard anybody advocate for, right? Because,
right.
You know, at the end
right.
of the day, Chris, a lot of the shareholders, especially of big public companies, are, you know, endowments for, you know, public pensions and, or, you know, whatever,
right.
Foundations for public pensions and endowments for universities. And, you know, a lot of the returns that come from, you know, a GE or an Apple or whatever it might be, are going to support those other causes. It's not all Scrooge McDuck, you know? And at the end of the day, we got to still, you know, I think we as businesses need to continue to have a healthy, you know, flow of capital so that, you know, we're rewarding risk taking and, you know, giving the benefit of those returns to kind of go into more innovation. So I appreciate that you highlighted that. Where, you know, as we're advocating for this balanced scorecard, balancing across different stakeholders, we're not saying, you know, we're not saying that we're leaving shareholders out. They're definitely a key part of this transformation. And to me, it's encouraging to see a lot of the, you know, kind of shareholder decision makers, be they endowments or, you know, investors. You know, I think you brought up BlackRock is, you know, they care about this too, and they're pushing this in that direction.
Yeah. That's very important. And I think that's a new phenomenon, a very new phenomenon. I just was talking to an asset manager a few days ago, and he said, you know, that, you know, there's really been a, you know, people really believe this is the better way to do it now. Whereas, you know, 5, 7 years ago, there was a lot of skepticism that it was people that had some maybe, you know, sort of liberal agenda was trying to push this on the asset managers. And even then there was evidence. So there's always been, you know, evidence that, you know, managing in an ESG way is better for the long term. But for a long time, people didn't believe that because, you know, again, maybe they thought it was, you know, yeah, people that had more of a political reason for publishing those studies than otherwise. But I think recently people begun to really sort of understand that this is actually something that you can count on and it's, yeah, taking off.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm glad to see it. You know, it may just take some time for these ideas to settle in someone's mind or there's some initial skepticism.
Right.
And then, you know, you see some other people kind of going forward and you're saying, OK, well, that's a smart team. Maybe there's something to it. But yeah, it does seem like it's kind of hitting this tipping point. And I appreciate what, you know, you've done and continue to do, Chris, through your case studies, your teaching, and now this book to help elevate what I think is a really important movement in our society. So maybe as we kind of get toward wrapping up here and, you know, certainly bring up anything else that you want to talk about, but I'd love to hear what you think of as the future for the B Corp movement, kind of where is this going next and how, you know, how can we as, you know, just everyday citizens, as people who are leaders within organizations, and as people who care about this movement, how can we be hopeful about the future of capitalism?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. So one, I think it's moving to a phase where it's going to be a lot more large companies. So, you know, there is a lot of sort of well-known companies, you know, be it, you know, some Kickstarter, Patagonia, Seventh Generation, Ben and Jerry's, you know, that are taking this on. But those are all actually relatively small compared to sort of global public giant companies. And I think the next phase is going to be finding on-ramps for larger companies, be it, you know, Danone, like I mentioned, you know, Unilever is very, you know, involved in the movement too. So two of the companies I mentioned, Ben & Jerry's and Seventh Generation, are actually owned by Unilever.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, so, so you can get a B Corp certification for kind of a sub brand or a subsidiary.
Yeah, so not a sub brand, but a subsidiary. So it's a legally separate subsidiary.
Got it.
And both those companies were at least seventh generation. I know it was a B Corp before Unilever purchased it. And so that happens a lot where companies, you know, will purchase a company that is a B Corp and then keep the certification. It'll still be a separate legal entity.
Got it.
On the flip side, some companies, larger companies, are saying, okay, let's actually use this as a differentiator. Maybe a subsidiary that has, you know, special more socially engaged focus. Like for instance, Gap has Athleta as a brand, and Athleta is a B Corp because of the social sort of work that it does. So I think that one thing is that it's going to be much larger companies that are coming on board. One of the companies, I think it's going to end up being the largest B Corp after everything's all settled, is Natura, which is a Brazilian-based cosmetics company. You know, big into natural ingredients, and very much has like sort of an Avon model, and part of that, you know, where it's all individual sort of mini entrepreneurs that are out there selling, and part of the model is helping, you know, these women mostly with career skills and sort of a way to sort of lift themselves up. And they have a couple million of these, you know, sort of Natura ladies that are, you know, in Brazil. So this was a large company in of itself. It, I think, was the first public B Corp traded in the São Paulo exchange. But they also recently have purchased The Body Shop, which is, you know, UK-based, famous for its social impact. Social impact ingredients, and then just within the last year, purchased Avon itself.
Oh,
so,
wow!
So they're in the process of getting sort of the whole, you know, legal aspect and certification settled for the whole brand. But I think in the end, it'll be a $10 billion company certified as B Corp. And then Danone, as the example, is a $30 billion company and is committed to becoming a B Corp by 2025. And currently about 30% of Danone's revenue, you know, including the North American subsidiary, which is a $6 billion company, is under the B Corp certification. So I think so one aspect is this sort of it's moving to larger companies, and B Lab is creating sort of new ways to on-ramp large companies so that, you know, these tools and processes can be used for large companies. I think two, and this I think follows with the millennials, Gen Zs, you know, there is going to be increasing interest from consumers on this. I think we started along the path, and I think there's been, you know, good progress, but I don't think it's something that's tipped yet. I think that, you know, this is something I think consumers can, you know, we all, with all the products that we buy, can sort of think about, you know, is this a good company? You know, I think that we look for things like, you know, fair trade and other certifications. But I think the B Corp logo, I hope, will also take on that role. And then finally, I think, you know, one of the things that I think is where a lot of my work is these days, sort of my next sort of set of book, set of research is going to be on externalities and how, you know, there are, you know, companies are getting away with a lot of sort of free lunches, so to speak, by, you know, putting costs that actually in the past companies would bear to society. So, you know, the gig economy is an example of this, whereas companies used to have great pensions, great benefits. It's a heck of a lot cheaper to actually not have to do any of that, but then who pays? It's, right. you know, someone goes to hospital, they don't have health insurance, it ends up being sort of us, you know, all that end up paying this, or pollution issues. And there's a lot of attention, you know, around this, around plastics and how, you know, this, you know, creative ways that we can actually try to internalize some of those externalities. So I hope that, you know, new systems could be created to really help companies see how they can become better, you know, better corporate citizens.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's a great thing to look at, and I'll be looking forward to that book on externalities, because there's so much that this B Corp model or the socially responsible model is trying to, you know, through transparency and through, you know, rewarding people who do it well, recognize that there are a bunch of those externalities. And even though, you know, you might not have a big lawsuit in 2 years for the, you know, the litter that is a result of your plastics or something, those costs are borne somewhere anyways. And, you know, I appreciate how the B Corp model and this movement is kind of seeking to have a positive force toward, let's reward and let's recognize companies who are doing this well and, you know, kind of paying for their own externalities or offsetting them. But, you know, I think it can be an important piece as leaders kind of think about getting on this train of realizing, yeah, there actually are a bunch of things that I could be helping with that I'm really kind of pushing costs off somewhere else. And to your point, Chris, we all end up bearing those costs. It's not like they disappear.
And I think that, yeah, people don't really, I think, recognize and see all that. But if you think about sort of in some ways, you know, this is the, you know, ethics expert podcast, like some of the ethical dimensions of this, I think it's, yeah, making other people pay for your waste is not a good thing to do. And so,
right.
And our system is sort of is built around that. So I hope that, you know, they're, you know, in the future, companies can sort of see that more as part of it, what's their responsibility. Because I do think it is also an ethical question.
That's great. Well, as we wrap up, Chris, you know, we've been talking today about your new book, Better Business: How the B Corp Movement is Remaking Capitalism. Tell us, Chris, how can we find you? How can we support this effort? And what can you know, our audience do to help get this idea out there?
Sure. So I think, you know, one thing, I mean, if you want to learn more about the book, you can go to my website, which is just my name, chrismarquist.com, and learn, you know, there's links to certainly buy the book, or you can also read some, you know, what others have said about it. And some the content on that will be built out. It's actually, the book is coming out September 13th, so we'll have a robust set of things at the website then. I think more generally, people, obviously, you could buy it from your, you know, local independent bookstore. You can buy it from obviously Amazon or all the bookstores. I think too, you know, this is something that is great to have dialogue about. And so, you know, sort of talk to your friends about the importance of this and buy, you know, at the end of the day, you know, when you buy products, think about, okay, what's the company like that I'm actually buying from? And I think, you know, the B Corp label is a good way to sort of differentiate the authentic companies from the maybe not authentic companies. But also there's, you know, we all live and play, we know, you know, sort of some retailers or small businesses, small bookstores or whatever. So, you know, I mean, try to support it through your purchases, companies and individuals that you know are also making a difference.
Great. Thank you for that, Chris. Yeah. As you know, as much as we kind of tend to talk about our actions and decisions in the workplace on our podcast, the decisions that we make on, you know, maybe where we invest our 401k or where we invest, you know, our right. purchasing dollars are ways that we can help signal to businesses that, hey, we care. We care about those externalities, and we want to be part of the companies and the brands that are doing things right and taking consideration for their employees and for their community, for the environment, you know, in addition to their shareholders.
Yeah, exactly.
It's been great spending some time with you, Chris. Thank you for sharing your insights, and really thank you for writing this book and sharing these views with the world. Again, everyone can go to chrismarquist.com to find information on the book. You can also go, you know, if you want to learn more about B Corporations, you can go to bcorporation.net. And, you know, I think that's a great encouragement that you gave us, Chris, to have conversations with people around you to start, you know, seeing what you and people in your community do can do to be part of this movement.
Super. Great. Thanks so much, Gio. It's great to be part of the podcast.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on.